Thursday, September the 1st, 2016. This is the show about stuff that interests me, like our current police state, information security, and wondering where the hell everybody else has already gone for Labor Day. I'm Morps, and tonight, I've got myself.
Oh, fuck.
That's okay, though. I have the last of my Corsair Spiced Rum, which will be finishing that off tonight, and we have the virtual.
Testicular cancer.
No.
And we have the virtual sword.
Sword.
So we at least have pretend friends here tonight, right? Anyways, so fuck it, doing it live, doing it solo. Moving on into the first topic I wanted to talk about. There are a lot of people on YouTube having a shit fit at the moment. First article up here is from The Verge. Copy that link, throw that in the chat room here. Yeah, I got actually all the space I normally am doing show stuff while I let other people talk. That's might end up just being dead air. Well, whatever. So, first article is from The Verge here. Why is YouTube being accused of censoring bloggers? So, a change in YouTube's content moderation system has left many video creators uncertain of their place on the platform. Over the past day, users have been posting notices from Google saying certain videos were being barred from making money via YouTube's ad service. More troubling, the videos were often flagged for reasons that seemed unfair, unclear, or outright censorious. But statements from YouTube suggest the real problem isn't a new policy. It's a long-running conflict between the platform's stated rules and their opaque, clumsy execution. The flagging started getting widespread attention after YouTube host Philip DeFranco posted a video stating, called YouTube is shutting down my channel, and I'm not sure what to do. While the title was hyperbole, DeFranco said on Twitter that over a dozen of his videos have been flagged as inappropriate for advertising, including one dinged for graphic content or excessive strong language. Yeah, well, Pure Decking would be shut down pretty quick. I mean, I was like 2 seconds in and dropping the F-bomb, right? But, also, having redone my setup a little bit, I can watch and make sure my 3D printer doesn't fail while I'm in the middle of the show. Of course, with nobody else on it, that would just mean me dropping the mic and running downstairs to put the fire out and dead air, right? But, hey, whatever. Anyways, so graphic content. While saying that YouTube was within its rights to make this call, he described the system as censorship with a different name because if you do this on the regular and you have no advertising, it's not sustainable. Many other YouTubers have posted their own notices, which covers everything from LGBT history videos to skincare tutorials. Kind of wonder if some of the skincare tutorials might just be an excuse to show off, right? But sometimes they're simply bemusing. Sometimes they seem to make serious political discussion or reporting non-monetizable. One notice sent to the popular Vlogbrothers channel covered both vegetables that look like penises and Zatari thoughts from a refugee camp. But a YouTube representative soon responded to DeFranco on Twitter. No policy change here, they wrote, just an improved notification process to ensure creators can appeal. We've got another article here from IndieWire basically stating the same thing. I don't really need to read this one out. The point here is that whereas I don't think YouTube has actually changed their policies any, what they have done is they've started enforcing them. And they're flagging videos not as just plain inappropriate, but inappropriate for advertising. So what that really means is they're getting told by, I don't know, the car companies, or I think movie ads are the last couple of things I saw on YouTube, was ads for what looked like crappy movies. I don't see a lot of the ads on YouTube anymore, thanks to some of my filtering, but there are still ads on there that make it through, and these advertisers are obviously not happy about their ads pre-rolling in front of, I don't know, some of these political commentators or some of the social justice types or, you know, some of these very controversial, very what would you say, not mainstream viewpoints? You ever notice, I mean, most companies, despite the political views of the people who work there or, even big name celebrities, right? You very rarely know what a big promoter, what their political views are. Like, the easy example is from a couple of years back when his name was a little bit bigger, Michael Jordan, you know, used to be a big name for selling shoes and Nike gear and t-shirts. You'd never know the guy was a huge Democrat and gave all kinds of money to the Democrats. But they kept that very, very quiet because you don't want to alienate half of your you don't want to alienate half of your potential market for political views. Oh, I can't buy those shoes. That's a Democrat shoe. You don't want that. Just it's an example. But at the same token, Psychros, like in the chat room there, we don't like that our advertisement for the latest movie is on how to use a BitTorrent client. Yeah, I can see that. It's like, you know, here's the ad for the movie, then here's how they instill the instructions on how to steal the movie, right? So obviously they don't like the concept there. And I kind of understand where the advertisers are coming from. And really, you have to remember, YouTube is not some kind of a public platform. It's not this commons free speech area. I mean, YouTube could have taken these videos down. I mean, think about this for a minute, right? YouTube is just saying, no, you can't monetize on these because advertisers are potentially unhappy with the content in these videos. They're not saying you can't go out and get your own sponsors, because several people who do professional YouTube channels do that. They're not taking their videos down. I mean, I could see the business decision being made of, well, we're not making money off these videos. Why should we host them? They're leaving them up. They're just saying, no, you can't... You just can't run ads on here because our ads are going to conflict with the content of the video, and we're going to make the advertisers unhappy. So, but of course, the YouTube content creators are going, well, now wait a minute. This means I can't make any money off my videos off YouTube. It means they have to go do a little bit of work themselves if they want to make money. And there's other video platforms out there if they truly feel like YouTube is no longer a viable platform for them. You know, like I said, I'm amazed if you would have. I think like Daily Motion actually did take down videos they couldn't monetize. They certainly wouldn't be the first website to do that. I find it amusing that you have so many people losing their mind over it. However, to be frank, for a lot of these guys, it's their livelihood. This advertising money is how they fund their channel. It's how they eat. It's how they pay the rent. So I understand why they're upset about this, whether it's a policy change or just enforcing a policy that's been there all this time. Of course, if you suddenly start enforcing a policy, even if the policy hasn't changed, you're enforcing it now, it's a policy change. So YouTube saying, oh, no, nothing has changed. Bullshit. Something's changed. So, you know, I mean, I kind of understand where YouTube is coming from of saying YouTube's customer is not the video providers. YouTube's customer is the advertiser. So if the advertiser says, we can't advertise on front of this video of a bald chick with black lipstick screaming about how horrible anything with a penis is, I understand where that advertiser's coming from. It's like, yeah, we just don't want to be associated with that. Or, you know, the guys who make Alex Jones look tame, it's like, yeah, we don't really want our movie to have anything to do with that guy. Because, you know, it's all guilt by association. Hell, look at Trump and Hillary right now. They're all pointing to all the horrible people they've dealt with, saying, see, look, this person's horrible. They know this horrible person, and vice versa. And it's again, politics is easy to point to right now because it's all over the place. But, you know, guilt by association is absolutely a thing, at least in public discourse. So I can totally see how, you know, somebody has a video full of some people swearing their heads off more than we do on this show. And, you know, an advertiser just not wanting anything to do with it. So I certainly understand where the advertisers are coming from on this. I guess what I don't like about it is the abruptness. I mean, it's a policy change. They could have given some warnings. They could have, you know, gone out to some of these bigger channels. Like, YouTube doesn't know who the big channels on their network are. Bullshit. You know, it's like, well, we see you're making your livelihood from YouTube. I mean, they know. Surely they know who it is. And then, you know, you might give them a heads up. I think they even have, for some of their bigger channels, you know, some kind of dedicated reps who are supposed to work with them on some of this content and things like that. So I don't, you know, I'm certain if somebody, you know, if somebody at YouTube said, you know, we might lose PewDiePie over this, somebody's going to give PewDiePie a call and, you know, give them a heads up and get some input from some of their bigger channels. So the abruptness of it is interesting. I just find it amazing that, yeah, I'll be honest, I had no fucking clue who Philip DeFranco was before this. I never watched his channel, no idea who he is. And the fact that, you know, that's the one that blew this up, it's like, okay. Never watched your channel, don't know who you are. Maybe he's funny as hell, I don't know. I don't know who he is. But, you know, it's interesting. So, I see, I mean, YouTube has every right to do it. This is one of the reasons why Pure Decking has always been an independent podcast on its own systems that I fucking pay for. It's not, you know, a YouTube channel or SoundCloud, because I I have no bones about it. I say some pretty out there shit, and I make fun of people and point and laugh, and that's kind of what the show is. It's us pointing and laughing at the internet so that we're not on top of the clock tower. And you know, again, it's a joke, and you know that joke right there would say, "I'm sorry, this channel is not eligible for advertising." So you made a clock tower joke, but yeah. So if you want to do sponsored content, and it's not going to be friendly for a platform, you know, maybe you should diversify. Maybe your channel, if it's a business, should be on multiple video sites, should have its own website, should have independent sponsors, ways of monetizing that aren't just dependent on YouTube ad revenue, which you have to think can't be that much unless you're just an absolutely amazingly huge channel. So yeah, that's funny, Psychrosis. It's like that's where everybody is tonight. They're on the clock tower. Well, you know, Madman's a decent shot. I'd be worried about that. Static, too, for that matter. Anyways. So, yeah, a lot of people are losing their mind over this. And, you know, some of the channels I do follow were posting protest videos and, you know, content restricted. And oh, my God. But, again, they're not actually pulling the videos down. Like, this is still costing YouTube. Psychros, we're not going to talk about RU and guns, but you would be surprised. Let me just put it that way. The thing is that, you know, it's going to cost YouTube bandwidth. If they're not going to advertise on these videos because they don't think it's content appropriate for advertising, that, you know, they're not making any money off of it other than just, you know, keeping people on the site. They're not, it's just going to cost them money to keep it up. So I don't know that what they've done is terribly unfair. In fact, I think it's pretty damned generous that they let people use the platform the way they do, and that video they can't monetize, they let stay up. So anyways, let's move on to news articles here. I don't have anybody to debate me on this. So there's that. The first article is from Yahoo News. FBI says foreign hackers penetrated state election systems. The FBI has uncovered evidence that foreign hackers penetrated two state election databases in recent weeks, prompting the Bureau to warn election officials around the country to take new steps to enhance the security of their computer systems, according to federal and state law enforcement officials. The FBI warning contained in a flash alert from the FBI's cyber division, a copy of which was obtained by Yahoo News, comes amid heightened concerns among U.S. intelligence officials about the possibility of cyber intrusions, potentially by Russian state. It's always the Russians. Why do we always blame the Russians? I thought we always blamed Chinese hackers first. Now it's Russian hackers. Aimed at disrupting the November elections. Really? You really think Russia is interested in disrupting the November elections? I can think of a lot more people who would be a lot more interested in disrupting the November elections than the Russians. Most likely, whichever side, Trump or Clinton, is down in the polls when the election opens, that's going to be the side that's more interested in disrupting the elections. These concerns prompted Homeland Security Secretary Jeh Johnson. Jeh, is that really how you say his name? I mean, that's how I've always heard it said, was Jeh. It's just, it seems like that's a... It's like, what happened? Well, his mother hiccuped when she was naming him, and that's what they put down. Jeh Johnson. So, I feel like it ought to be like Jeh Johnson or something like that. Homeland Security Secretary Jeh Johnson was to convene a conference call with state election officials on August 15th, in which he offered his department's help to make state voting systems more secure, including providing federal cybersecurity experts to scan for vulnerabilities. We're going to run Nessus and Nmap against it. God. Actually, that would probably be a step up from what they're doing, truth be told, according to a readout of the call released by the department. So, anyways, let's see. Johnson emphasized that in the call that Homeland Security was not aware of a specific or credible cybersecurity threats to the election, officials said. But 3 days after that call, Cybersecurity Division issued a potentially more disturbing warning titled Targeting Activity Against State Board of Election Systems. The alert, labeled as restricted for need-to-know recipients, but then how did Yahoo get it, disclosed that the Bureau was investigating cyber intrusions against two state election websites this summer. Now, that's a different story. The headline is the election, you know, they got into the election machines. This is saying they get into the websites. That's a little bit different. It's like, not that websites don't have, you know, important information on them, but it's not quite the same thing. Two election websites this summer, including one that resulted in exfiltration or theft of voter registration data. They wanted the phone numbers and they wanted the addresses. They wanted to do fraud. They didn't care about the election. It was an eye-opener, a senior law official, enforcement official said of the Bureau's discovery of the intrusions. We believe it's kind of serious and we're investigating. I love the quote. We believe it's kind of serious and we are investigating. I mean, it's like, holy shit, kind of serious. Well, if it's just websites, it may only be kind of serious, but they got voter registration information, so yes, it's serious. The bulletin does not identify the states in question, but sources familiar with the document say it refers to targeting by suspected foreign hackers of voter registration databases in Arizona and Illinois. The Illinois case, officials were forced to shut down the state's voter registration system for 10 days in late July after the hackers managed to download personal data on 200,000 state voters. Ken Metzel, the general counsel of the Illinois Board of Elections, said in an interview, the Arizona attack was more limited, involving malicious software that was introduced into its voter registration system, but no successful exfiltration of data. So they were going after the voter registration databases. They wanted names, phone numbers, and addresses. This was not an attempt to, at least this in itself was not an attempt to sway an election. Now, if they're going to go after all the names on that list, like, you know, leaving dead dogs in their yard with a knife stuck in it saying you're not voting for Trump, or Clinton, or, you know, pick your local official, right? But, God, that'd be a fun cyberpunk story, though. You know, somebody breaks into the database to get the voter lists for a political party, so they can then attempt to intimidate, like, entire states' worth of voters to swing elections. That'd be a fun story. We may have to go back to... We talked about doing this audio fiction on G15 before. That might be fun to explore. So they're tying this to the elections, obviously, for, you know, headline grabbing. It's clickbait. But the truth is that election registration databases do contain a lot of personal information, just like a lot of other things out there. And state governments do not exactly have a fantastic record when it comes to network security. So... Yeah, all you can really do is hope on this one, because that, or, you know, don't register to vote. It's like, what are you going to do? I'm not going to vote because I'm afraid the state can't keep my data safe. That's a man. That's a hard one way to go. So let's stick with Yahoo for a minute here. This next article is from Ars Technica. It is about an absurd settlement with Yahoo. So lawyers get million, consumers get nothing. Email snooping continues. In 2013, Yahoo announced that it would begin scanning its users' email for targeted advertising purposes, just like Google does. As is par for the course, class action lawsuits were filed. You do kind of wonder if there's just lawyers on hand waiting on a tech company to announce something so they can file a lawsuit. Probably are. As is par for the course, class action lawsuits were filed. The Silicon Valley media giant, according to one of the lawsuits, was violating the personal liberties of non-Yahoo Mail users. That's because non-Yahoo Mail users who have sent mail to Yahoo Mail users were having their email scanned without permission. The plaintiff and the classes are among the multitude of U.S. residents who have sent electronic communications or emails to a Yahoo user or users, and whose personal liberties have been and continue to be intruded upon by those with these private communications are read, or an alternative, eavesdropped upon by Yahoo. Well, if it's okay for Google to use automated crap, why is it not okay for Yahoo to use automated crap? The suit said that Yahoo's new scanning policies adopted under Yahoo chief Marissa Meyer violated federal and state privacy laws, and that Yahoo's email scanning regime seriously threatened the free exercise of personal liberties. There are other email providers, people. It's not that hard to get an email account if you want to get one that's not going to scan your shit. And is one of the types of behavior that U.S. Congress and California legislature has declared should not be tolerated in a free and civilized society. The suit, which was one of six, were commingled as a single class action lawsuit demanding that a judge halt the scanning and award each victim $5,000 or three times the actual damages in addition to reasonable attorney's fees and costs. So we've got the unreasonable amount of $5,000 to every user on the internet and then the reasonable attorney fees. We know which one they actually cared about. Fast forward 3 years, the case is now closed. Days ago, a Silicon Valley federal judge signed off on a settlement. The lawyers won. They were awarded $4 million, and the public got nothing. Literally, Yahoo just paid off the lawyers of the class action lawsuit. The settlement allows Yahoo to continue to scan emails without non-Yahoo users' consent. Yahoo Mail customers have granted consent to the scanning as a condition of using the service. And the major change the lawsuit produced was that Yahoo is agreeing to scan the email while it's at rest on the service instead of while the mail is in transit. This, according to the settlement, satisfies the California Invasion of Privacy Act's claims. The deal spells out that Yahoo only has to do this for 3 years, but Yahoo said it would continue the new scanning protocol after the 3 years expire. Well, duh, once you've got that system in place, there's no reason to rewrite it unless something breaks with it. So, I don't even need to finish with this. It just kind of fleshes out a little bit. Short version of it, Yahoo's going to continue to scan email, and they gave the lawyers $4 million to go away. So, in all seriousness, if you're concerned about email you were sending, don't use a free public email system like a Yahoo or a Google. If you have serious communications that you were concerned about, back to politics, you do what Hillary Clinton did and set up your own server. But, you know, actually secure yours. Because it's not that hard, it's not that expensive. And you can set up something like a Zimbra, or hell, even a Postfix box by reading up some internet tutorials, going out and getting a VPS. It'll cost like, I don't know, if you get choosy, you can probably get one for $5 a month. Like a DigitalOcean drop, it's like $10 a month. And you can run your own email server in the cloud cheaply without a problem. You'll need to register a domain for it. You can actually run one at home if your ISP doesn't filter port 25. So believe me, it's not that hard to set up an email server. Now, you do have to watch out for things like spam filtering. If you are going to run an email server, don't do it in Amazon. Don't do AWS, because damn near every one of their Elastic public IPs are blocked for spam filtering because people do that shit. And if your ISP does allow port 25, you do have to be sure that that you're not already on all the spam block lists. So it's not that hard to do, but there are some pitfalls to avoid. So yeah, I mean, I've got some private email systems, but yeah, I use Google. I don't care. honestly, there's nothing in my email that's that critical that I don't care if an ad blocker or advertiser system reads it. It's like, shit, the note from my mom, you really care? I mean, really? most people don't use email for anything anymore anyways, except for communication with websites. If you're communicating with people these days, you're probably using like a WhatsApp or a chat room or something. So, speaking of setting up your own... Yeah, I'm trying to segue here. Speaking of setting up your own services, Iran's doing that. This is from the BBC. Iran is rolling out its own domestic internet. So, an inauguration ceremony was held on Sunday for the company's Communications and Information Technology Minister, Mohad Vaziz. Vaziz? I don't know. The state news agency, IRNA, said the initiative would offer high-quality, high-speed connections at low cost. But critics suggest the true aim is to tighten the authorities' control over citizens' use of the net. Although Iran already blocks access to overseas-based social media services, including Twitter and Facebook, many users still connect to them via proxy sites and VPNs. Inefficient filters. The idea behind the project was first made public in 2010 and was originally intended to be fully operational by 2015. I think you missed your deadline, guys. The government said that the goal was to create an isolated domestic intranet that can be used to promote Islamic content and raise digital awareness among the public. It intends to replace the current system in which officials seek to limit which parts of the existing internet people have access to via filters, an effort Mr. Vaziz described as being inefficient. Well, he's probably right about that. So, yeah, Iran is going to build their own internet. My question is, how long before you have a couple of activists start building proxy servers between the Iranian internet and the public one? So you get on the Iranian internet, you go to the right website, and boom, you're on the regular internet. I mean, granted, they'll have a much easier time shutting that kind of stuff down, but all domestic activities, services, applications, and various type of content are included in the national internet, he declared at launch. I wish they'd call it something different. This is going to get confusing. The minister added that the initiative would make it easier to combat cyber threats. At the ceremony, another official stated that the Information Technology Ministry had recently had to combat several distributed denial-of-service attacks, which attempts to overwhelm its computer servers by flooding them with traffic. According to a report by Mehir, another Tehran-based news agency, the first phase of the rollout involves providing access to e-government services and domestic web pages. The second phase, due in 2017, will add domestic video content, so they're going to build their own YouTube. I wonder if this one will have the same advertising problem. Third phase, due in March 2017, will introduce further services and provide support for companies involved in international trade. Local reports state that users' privacy will be respected. Sure it will. But British Human Rights Campaign Group Article 19 has warned that this might not be the case. It might not be the case. You think? Given Iran's record in violating its human rights commitments based on civil and political, including religious and ethnic grounds, the developments of the project, such as the national internet, are especially concerning, it said in a report published earlier this year. The national internet project could pave the way for further isolation, surveillance, and information retention. It risks severely isolating the Iranian people from the rest of the online world, limiting access to information, and constraining attempts at collective action and public protest. I don't know, dude. I think they're going to try, but I think you're going to see pipes between their internet and the regular one spring up pretty damn quickly. And I don't think this is going to get used like a real internet. I think this is going to get used for... It's going to be like telex. Handful of services, handful of things, but no real... Yeah, nothing like the real internet, you know what I mean? It's going to be telex on computers. It's not going to be... Or I guess it's kind of like a cable television system where you have a handful of services you're allowed to select from and people kind of watch it, but they don't really interact with it. I don't think you're going to see the same level of use on this internet that you would see on the real one. So, moving on... And the next is from Opera.com's blog. Opera server breach. So I guess for anybody who isn't aware, there is another web browser out there called Opera. Opera has been around. They might predate Mozilla. I heard about Opera and Mozilla, not Firefox, Mozilla, at about the same time. And I knew several people back, in middle school and high school who used it. But, yeah, definitely longer than Firefox. But Firefox is based on the Mozilla code base, so I'm trying to remember if it's older. It can't be older than Mosaic. Mosaic was the first one. Mozilla, though, I don't know. Anyways, so Opera has always been struggling for... They've never really taken off. However, their mobile browsers back in the day started to. They started to take off, and then, you know, iPhones came out, and they kind of got screwed. But back in the PDA days, the Windows, you know, CE days, and early smartphones, Opera's mobile web browser worked better than anything else, and that was because what they were doing was you weren't truly browsing straight up on a public website. Opera's web browser was hitting a proxy server that Opera was running. And that proxy server was then downloading the page, recompressing it, and reworking it so it worked better on a mobile. And they've had these kind of cloud systems where, you know, their servers would do a lot of work for the browser for a very long time. So the fact that Opera's server just got breached is a problem. Earlier this week, we detected signs of an attack where access was gained to the Opera Sync system. This attack was quickly blocked. Our investigations are ongoing, but we believe some data, including some of our synced users' passwords and account information, such as login names, may have been compromised. Although we only store encrypted for synchronized passwords or hashed and salted for authentication passwords in this system, we have reset all Opera Sync account passwords as a precaution. We've also sent all emails to all Opera Sync users to inform them about the incident and ask them to change their password for all of their Opera Sync accounts. In an abundance of caution, we have encouraged users to also reset any passwords to third-party sites they may have synchronized with the service. To obtain a new password for Opera Sync, go to the page. Active number of users in Opera Sync is 1.7 million, less than 0.5% of total Opera user base of 350 million. The remaining Opera browser users who do not use Opera Sync do not need to take any action. So they apologize for the incident and blah, blah, blah. But, so, Opera, well, it's amazing that Opera's never really gotten off the ground the way the other browsers have, because they have been around forever. And their Sync server... Somebody got into it and started dumping data in, and they kicked them out and blocked it. But if you use Opera and you use the Opera Sync server, you need to go reset any password you may have touched in that browser, like ever. Because these browsers like to save your passwords, and they usually try to save every password you punch into it unless you specifically go in and turn it off. And I think I'm in a minority of users who actually turn that off, because I don't like the concept of you sit down in front of my computer and you now have access to all of my websites. No, I've never liked that concept. So I usually don't save my passwords in my browsers. I occasionally forget and screw up and let one or two get saved and have to remember to go clear them out. But if that's the case for Opera, any web browser... any web browser defaults where they're saving your passwords are probably up in that sync server, unless you have specifically not set things up that way. Although it sounds like it was not a majority of their user base using this system. Yeah, you had any passwords up there, you need to change them. And if you are going to store passwords, I'm actually playing around with LastPass right now, and fairly, I like it. It's not bad. I haven't sat there and watched the net traffic the way I should just yet, or watched the way it does autofill to make sure that it's all secure. But from just playing with the service so far, the freebie service, it's not bad. But yeah, if you use something that's dedicated and like a 1Password or a LastPass or KeePass, something with a reputation to it, yeah, I think that's a much better idea than using your browser's built-in Actually, the OS X keychain is surprisingly robust. So I guess Safari's isn't so bad if you're on OS X. So, yeah, Cycros is saying use your own self-hosted password systems. That might be feasible, but it kind of depends on what you're trying to accomplish. So if you're going with it being available everywhere, I've used KeePass databases can be opened on damn near anything these days, so they're not that hard to sync up. That's an easy way to go. But yeah, I've been playing around with LastPass just to see how I like it or not. So, but you know, of course, there's. I guess you could always just get the little notebook they sell that sells Password Vault and has a strap of elastic to protect your passwords, or you know, do the whole post-it note on a monitor thing. But anything's better than the post-it note on the monitor or the notebook, right? So, let's see. Next article here is from the TroyHunt.com blog, and this is pretty cool. And this is actually why I got looking at password managers earlier in the week and decided to start playing around with one of them. The Dropbox hack is real. It's real. Earlier today, Motherboard reported on what this is from the 31st. Earlier today, Motherboard reported on what had been rumored for some time, namely that Dropbox had been hacked, and not just a little bit hacked, but and not in that someone has cobbled together a list of credentials that could work on Dropbox hack either, but proper hack to the tune of 68 million records. Excuse me. Very shortly after, sent over the data, which once unzipped looked like, let's see, bf1.txt, bf2.txt, sha1.txt, sha2.txt. What they have here is two files with email addresses and bcrypt hashes, and another two with email addresses and sha1 hashes. It's a relatively even distribution of the two, which appears to represent a transition from the weaker sha1 variant to bcrypt's adaptive workload approach at some point in time. So, blah, 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 blah. Anyways, he looks and does see his old password hash for his own Hotmail account, of all things, in this data dump. He heads off to 1Password to get his Dropbox entry and check it, but he has changed the password in 2014, so he knows that his password was changed after the hack. However, his wife hadn't changed it since 2012, so he took the entry from her password, hashed it, because she's also using 1Password, so they had a relatively strong random password. It wasn't like a reuse situation. And generated the hash, compared it, and went, holy shit, they had the hash to his wife's password for that, because they used 1Password, was only in use in Dropbox, and wasn't used anywhere else, which means somebody got into Dropbox's databases back in 2012. You know, shit. Now, Dropbox had some security problems, you know, as they've gotten bigger. One of the more funny ones was where they weren't checking passwords at all, so you could just log in as anybody with any password for, like, 4 days or something like that. But, yeah, so because he was able to find the hash to his wife's password that was not used anywhere else for his wife's account, like her email address and everything, yeah, that means it's a legit dump, because there's no other way to get that data. So the Dropbox hack was real, and if you haven't changed your password in Dropbox in 6 years, you 4 years, yeah, a little Kentucky math there. If you haven't changed your Dropbox password in 4 years, you might want to go do that. Next one up is from ArsTechnica.com and is hilarious. Earlier this year, Facebook denied criticisms that its trending feature was surfacing news stories that were biased against conservatives. But in an abrupt reversal, the company fired all the human editors for trending on Friday afternoon and replaced them with an algorithm that promotes stories entirely based on what Facebook users are talking about. Within 72 hours, according to the Washington Post, the top story on trending was about how Fox News icon Megyn Kelly was a pro-Clinton traitor who had been fired. And none of that's true. The original accusations came from a disgruntled ex-editor at Facebook who leaked internal trending training materials to Gizmodo. The training materials offer tips, among other things, of how to curate news from an RSS feed of reputable sources when the stories provided by Facebook users were false or repetitive. Though the human editors were always expendable, they were mostly there to train the trending algorithm, and they were still engaging in quality control to weed out blatant falsehoods and non-news like hashtag lunch. After trending launched on the fake Kelly scoop, it appears that the human intervention might still be required to make Facebook's algorithms a legitimate source of news after all. In a post about the changes, Facebook said the early move to eliminate the human editors was a direct response to the feedback we got from the Facebook community earlier this year. They got caught being politically one-sided. And an oblique reference to the raging controversy unleashed by Gizmodo's revelations. Facebook explained that the new non-human trending module is personalized based on a number of factors, including pages you've liked, your location, the previous trending topics with which you've interacted, and what is trending across Facebook overall. Instead of paying humans to write topic descriptions and short story summaries, the company said we're relying on an algorithm to pull excerpts directly from the news stories, which is why millions of Facebook readers this morning saw the news that Megyn Kelly was a traitor who had been fired. All the example stories. Supposedly, humans are still involved with trending in a few ways, such as confirming that a topic is tied to current news event in the real world. The process appears to have a few bugs. The trending news article about Kelly is ending the Fed article that was basically just a block quote of a blog post from the National Insider Politics, which itself was actually aggregated from a third conservative site, Conservative 101. All three sites use the same breaking headline. The Conservative 101 post is three paragraphs long and basically reads as an anti-Kelly fan fiction accusing her of being a closet liberal, blah 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 blah. So yeah, the thing couldn't, their algorithm could not tell that they had picked up somebody's spoof site or some absolute wacko's page and started promoting some of these absolutely fake stories, which is awesome. Let's see, what there were some other fake ones that were just hilarious. I must have seen that in a different article about it, though, because I don't see it on this one. So yeah, there were some other ones that were just absolutely out there, like aliens were landing and France didn't exist or something like that. So, I mean, it was just picking out some absolutely nutty articles to promote, which is just fantastic. If it's based on Facebook user activity, it kind of makes you wonder, you know? So, anyways, let's see. Next article here. This is from Scrower.com. And is a story about how WoSign is a Chinese SSL certificate seller, by the way. Basically, he was able to get a GitHub.com certificate and a certificate for his domain, his university's domain. So, you know what? I'm just going to explain this real quick. I'm not going to read the whole article. What he was doing was he was registering for certificates for subdomains. Like, he had set up a GitHub Pages account and he had a user page on his university account. So he was getting like a username.github.io or getpages.io, whatever it was. And he was doing, you know, of course, his university account. So he had subdomains on there. So he was getting a SSL certificate for the subdomain. Well, it turned out that WoSign was not just giving out the subdomain, they would give him a certificate for the primary domain, which means they probably had an error in their script generation or their certificate generation scripting that was kind of making the assumption that you'd only ever be registering an SSL cert for a top-level domain. So when he checked the cert, and the cert also happens to work for the root, he realized he could, you know, set up a fake GitHub.com and it would be SSL verified, right? Against the WoSign cert. This is why certificate pinning is important and should be done if you are serious about your website security. Make sure that you're getting your certificate from the right place. But yeah, WoSign said, oh, we screwed up and we're going to try to do better in the future. It's like, oh, yeah, oops, sorry. They say they've invalidated them, but, you know, that doesn't actually work nearly as well as people think it does. So, because and the reason that is a lot of SSL verification systems they fail open. They'll fail that if they can't communicate and verify a certificate, they'll often assume that the certificate is good, and that's dumb for user end user convenience, because you know, if VeriSign goes down, how many websites wouldn't work because you can't verify the SSL certificate, kind of thing. So it was a reliability issue that they fail open, and now it's causing security issues because all you got to do is set up a man in the middle, and somehow, if you're already man-in-middling one site, you can just block communication to the SSL certificate provider, and oh, it's a good certificate, right? And it fails open, so yeah. But of course, this would pass without having to even man in the middle. This just, you know, you could straight up fish people and have it work. So yeah, you got to do certificate pinning, and if you're, I believe, what's it called, open or SSL, shoot, I forget what it's called, but there's an initiative to get certificate providers, SSL transparency, that's what it's called, where certificate providers are supposed to publish a list of what certificates they publish so that you could verify and make sure that nobody else has registered a certificate for your website, because that would be a problem. But, yep. Anyways, apparently he was able to do that. He had these certificates for like over a year, and they still worked. So, yeah, don't trust all these cert providers if you can help it. Let's see. I'm going to skip this story because it's stupid and go straight into this. Yo! Hadouken! All right, so for Digital Dojo, first thing I have up is a app on the XDA forum called Sunhide, or SUHide. What this thing does is it allows you to select on an application level to hide the fact that your phone is rooted from the application. So things like Android Pay, Duo, several MDM providers like MobileIron are good. They'll have a bitch fit if the phone's rooted and they're set up to complain about that. Not to mention a lot of banking applications, other things. So, oh, phone's rooted, we're not going to run because we think it's insecure. Which, to be fair, a rooted phone is less secure than an unrooted phone, because a rooted phone can run damn near anything, whereas an unrooted phone can only run signed code. Same thing with an iPhone. If you jailbreak your iPhone, you can do a hell of a lot more with it, and it's a much more useful device, but it's less secure. And you just need to know that when you're rooting your phone or jailbreaking your phone, and just be aware of it. You know, one of the early, I think it was the iPhone 3G, everybody who had rooted it, they weren't aware that the root system added an SSH server, and the default root password on iPhones was Alpine for the longest time. So people were getting Rickrolled because they didn't change the root password on their rooted cell phone, and, you know, just sitting out there on the internet with an SSH server on their phone. So, you know, people would SSH into them, change your wallpaper, change your ringtones, and you got Rickrolled. So, anyways, this application allows you to hide the fact that the phone is rooted from things like Android Pay. However, the author goes on saying that it's temporary, they're going to patch around it, it's not a reliable method, it was more done as an experiment. But if you have a phone, you need it rooted, and you have an application that doesn't like it rooted, it might be worth exploring for you. You will probably... Did he provide a binary? Looks like it, yeah. So he's got binaries published on the forum post there. So if you don't know how to sideload apps, probably shouldn't be screwing with this in the first place. But, yeah, it would... Oh, Cycross is saying Exposed has some methods to do this. Yes, it does, but this does not need Exposed. That's one of the nice that's one of the nice benefits of this app, is that he did it without using the Exposed framework. So you don't need a custom... Well, Exposed is for kind of making custom ROMs out of your stock ROM. Anyways, not my point. But it's neat. It's experimental. He's just playing around, but it worked. So worth looking into. And then the final thing is from adaxes.com. It's a very nice write-up on cleaning up your Active Directory using PowerShell. It has scripts on here for deleting empty OUs, deleting empty groups, deleting inactive computers, and deleting inactive user accounts. This is all fairly basic, straightforward PowerShell stuff if you've done any basic administrative work. But he's already got the scripts written up. They're well documented. So if you wanted something to hack on as a starting point for putting together some automatic cleanup, yeah. So the nice little set of AD PowerShell scripts. And it's just a quick way to clean out your Active Directory and try to keep it maintained. So, anyways, that's all I've really got for tonight. I hope I didn't ramble on too much, but I had to fill all the air myself as opposed to taking a break. And, don't worry, I'm going to give all the other guests shit for making me do this solo, but I've always threatened I will do it solo if I have to. And let me just check. Does anybody have anything else before we close out?
No, Sard.